Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're with RCR Greenwashed with Jaspreet and Don. And last week we started off in Virginia, we went up to Pennsylvania, and we are going further north today into New York State, where we have a former guest back on RCR Greenwashed. His name is Francis J. Menton Jr. He has a long career in the legal profession, graduating from Yale initially with economics and mathematics, and his legal background from Harvard in 1975, actually. And he had 40 years as a in the legal field, I would say, a very lightweight way of saying he was busy in the legal fraternity. So, and since 2012, he is published under the moniker of the Manhattan Contrarian. And when he retired in 2016, I would suggest his output has even become more prolific. So we've got Francis Menton back on today. Welcome, Francis. We want to hear your opinion about the election of Donald Trump, the fallout, the good, the bad, the ugly, how you see it.
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on. Second of all, that's a subject I could probably talk for the whole hour if you didn't interrupt me, but I'll try to give a few high points and then allow you the chance to ask me to go off in other directions. I've actually looked into a lot of the details of how the election came out in different locations, different states, the Congress, and so forth. The first thing, and I'm sure, because I know you guys have pretty good access to U.S. news, and maybe your readership will be pretty on top of it, as I am totally not on top of news from New Zealand, because it's hard for us to get. But I'm sure you've seen that all the polls showed this was going to be an extremely close election. It could go either way. It might take a long time to figure out who the winner was, because we have a complicated system that goes state by state. And some of the states have crazy rules and take a long time counting ballots, and everybody was afraid it could go on for a long time. And it turned out that Trump won quite decisively, and the answer was known early in the morning of the Wednesday after Election Day. And Trump won every single one of the swing states that were thought to be determinative of the election. He didn't win any of them by a big margin. I mean, the biggest margin, I think, in those swing states was under 5%, but he won all of them by enough to avoid recounts and problems, the minimum of 1% to 2% and up to about 4% to 5% in those states. So it's absolutely clear that Trump is going to be the incoming president. I haven't heard any and I haven't seen any news about legal challenges that think they can keep him out, or maneuvers that are going to be tried to prevent him from taking office. It wouldn't surprise me if they don't come up. If they came up with some, I almost would be shocked if they didn't. But so far, I haven't heard anything about that. So it looks like Trump is clearly going to be the president. Over in the Congress, again, it was pretty close, but it looks like he has won decisively in both houses of the Congress. And I'll take them separately. There's the House of Representatives and the Senate. Again, your people probably know most of this stuff, but the Senate has two roles. One is legislation, and the other is approving nominations of the president. Actually, they have a third role, which is approving treaties. So approving the nominations and approving treaties is not part of the House of Representatives. To approve a nomination, it requires a simple majority, 51 votes. It looks like the Republicans have at least 53. Now, I think there's one seat that may still be at issue, but I think the Republican is trailing by sufficiently that she's not going to catch up. So So 53, well, 53 might not sound like all that many out of 100. It's a bare majority. But you may remember in Trump's first term, he only had 51 in the Senate. And there are several iffy senators who are not reliable votes for the Republicans. And as a result of that, he had a terrible time staffing his administration. And multiple appointments sat around unfilled. I mean, I don't know if you remember, the attorney general was substantially delayed in getting confirmed. And the assistant attorney generals, there was one guy who was a friend of mine who was appointed to be an assistant attorney general. And it took him over a year to get a confirmation vote in the Senate. And meanwhile, there's nobody to staff. He was the environmental division of the Justice Department, nobody to staff it. This time, they have 53 senators. So these iffy votes, and you may know some of these names, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, they're still in the Senate. Mitt Romney was another one. He has left. So, but even if those two don't vote for him or vote for a particular nominee, he's still got enough to get his nominees through. So it should go much more quickly. And over in the House of Representatives, it looks like the Republicans have picked up one seat from their bare majority, where they got a four-seat majority out of 435. They seem to have gone to five. Oh, and he's just nominated two of those people to positions in the administration. He nominated one to be the UN ambassador, one of the Republican Congress people, and he's nominated now another to be the attorney general. Then they have to have a special election. So with an extremely narrow majority. So there's a lot of, there's going to be a lot of maneuvering going on, but it looks like he does have a sufficient majority to be a working majority in both the House and the Senate.
So this seemed, as you point out in your latest missive, he did a poor job of picking some of his representatives last time, and hopefully he has got it a whole lot more organized this time and doesn't have that sort of awkwardness and having to move people on when they don't perhaps represent what he needs. Is the influences of the likes of the Mitch McConnell type crew still playing a big part? Because from afar, I looked at Mitch McConnell as being, and I may be upsetting your view, I don't know, as a bit of a spoke in the wheel for his last administration. Would that be a fair comment or not? And is he still having any influence? I know Mitch is sort of getting past it, but...
Well, Mitch McConnell has been the minority leader. Before that, he was the majority leader. So he's been the leader of the Republicans in the Senate for quite a while. I can't tell you exactly how many years, more than 10. I mean, so for quite a while, some periods in the minority and some in the majority. In Trump's first term, when he had 51 senators to work with, he did incredible work getting Trump's judge nominees approved. A lot of people speak ill of Mitch McConnell. He did an incredible job getting Trump's judicial nominees through a Senate where he had only one spare to work with, and he had Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, and Mitt Romney as thorns in his side that he had to deal with. And he had to make promises and commitments to them on other issues to get their votes to approve a judge. So he had a very difficult job before him. Well, McConnell is getting on in years. He's still a senator. He announced that he would give up he would not become the majority leader if the Republicans won. He said he was not going to run for that this time, and he did not. And they just had the selection, and the guy who apparently has won, and I just was reading this before coming on here, the guy who apparently has won is named John Thune, T-H-U-N-E. He is a senator from South Dakota. I would say that, and he's been elected by the Republican senators. I'm sure Trump communicated to somebody or other, maybe to a lot of people, who his preference was. The rumor is that Thune was not his first choice. I think that Thune is thought to be not a bomb thrower and more of a compromiser. But on the other hand, he's not a Lisa Murkowski or a Susan Collins or a Mitt Romney, okay? And he's from South Dakota, which is a very, very, very Republican state. So anyway, it looks like he's the guy who has won that. I have met him because I once contributed enough money to get to go to a fundraiser with him. And he seems like a very together guy. He's a very right. tall, skinny guy.
I think he's a together guy.
So
I'll keep an eye out for him. And sorry if I had misconstrued Mitch McConnell's past. It's just from afar, you get a view that think you don't understand the whole gaming that's going on behind. So
yeah,
one thing I'd like to just move on to quickly before we get off this topic and onto more climate type stuff, net zero stuff, is Donald Trump seems to be plucking a few people out of basically the business sector, Elon Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy, to lead the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. That could be taken as dodgy, but it's not. It's Department of Government Efficiency. What's your take on getting people that have basically been in the real world to assist in this sort of capacity?
Well, I think it's terrific in general. I mean, the history of cabinet appointments is there normally are multiple that come from the private sector. I mean, God knows, in his first term, I don't know if you remember this, is the first guy he nominated for Secretary of State was named Rex Tillerson, who was the CEO of Exxon. And I thought the heads of the climate people were going to explode over that. And Tillerson had a little trouble getting confirmed, but he was confirmed. And then he turned out to be not a serious climate skeptic at all. I couldn't even figure it out. Let alone he didn't get along too well with Trump on various foreign policy issues, and he didn't last very long, and he got bounced right out. Now, but that's not really a critique of businessmen in government generally. I think that's a particular issues that were personal to Tillerson and Trump. There are plenty of examples. For example, the Treasury Secretary is often a Wall Street guy. And Trump picked a Treasury Secretary named Mnuchin, who came out of Wall Street. And Hank Paulson, you might remember from the Bush time, came out of Wall Street. And Rubin, who was Clinton's Treasury Secretary, came out of Wall Street. So the Treasury Secretary position is often filled by a banker or a financial guy without a lot of prior government service. And there are many other examples like that.
Right. And last question on this from me anyway is Elise Stefanik as the UN ambassador appointee, is she the sort of person we need to, I mean, we in this show, we often attack some of the output of the United Nations, especially under the climate heading. So is she the sort of person that will have the interests of the United States taxpayer first, or...
Absolutely. She and by the way, she is a member of the congressional leadership of the Republicans. I think, and the congressional, you know, there's 435 Congress people, and the congressional leadership of each party consists of only four or five people. And she's head of, I think, what's called the Republican Conference or something like that. So she's one of the top three or four or five. Republicans in Congress in terms of elected leadership. She's from the state of New York. She represents far upstate. Like again, I don't know how familiar you guys are with the U.S. or New York, but New York has a big city in the south, and in the north, it's a huge empty area called the Adirondack Park. It's like 15,000 square miles or something like that. And that's her district. It has no population centers of note. She's been the congressperson there for 10 years, I think. The first time she won it, she took it from a Democrat in a very close election. And now in the last one, she's won it like 62-38. So she's turned that area red. Maybe it would have gone red on its own. And she is a very articulate person. I think she was the youngest congressperson when first elected, so just over 30, which would make her just over 40 now. And went to Harvard, very smart, sharp as a tack, and she's going to be terrific as the UN ambassador.
Wow. We need a multitude of at least Stefaniks by the sound of it in those roles.
You're going to like her.
So look, let's moving on. Your output is constant. You know, you're part of the Global Warming Policy Foundation. You're on the board of that, and you're a member of the CO2 Coalition. We have on the show a lot of emphasis on the output that is trying to, you know, people call it the skeptical side of climate science. We would rather say it's the realistic side of climate science. We try to put those cases. And your latest missive talks about a lot of advice that you would like to communicate with President Trump, or if he was to sort of take notice. Can you sort of run through those? Are you sort of, if you were the mentor for Donald Trump, what would be your top of the list to do?
That's to attack, to address?
To address, yes.
So
day one.
Yes. So I have just put out this post yesterday. So these are my big ideas, but start with this. The president has a lot of leeway, but if he wants to do anything budgetary or change major policies by legislation, he's got to get it through Congress. And in the best case, even when he's got a working majority in Congress, that's going to take a while, like a year at best. And in a worst case, anything controversial is never going to get through there, particularly because on non-budgetary matters, the Senate basically requires 60 votes and he only has 53. So the first thing I start with is, what can the president do on his own? What doesn't require anything from the Congress? And item number one that occurs to me is government communications. I'm sure it's true in New Zealand too. Our government has enormous amounts of websites and web pages, thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And to the extent they have anything to do with climate under the Biden administration and previously under Obama, they are just filled with the climate crisis, climate alarm, how we're solving it, in every way, shape, form, and manner. And when Trump came in the first time in 2017, one of the first things I was looking to is, so what is he going to do with this EPA website? And I would go to the EPA website every few days and see what new stuff, how are they getting rid of the old stuff, and what new are they putting up? And the incredible thing was, it didn't change. And it didn't change for all this alarm stuff was up there for a year and more and 2 years. And then it started to change a little by little, but all this crazy climate alarm stuff was up there. And finally, in his last year, I thought the website straightened out. And then Biden came in and they changed it all back in one day. And of course they did. They were on top of it. I thought that was one of Trump's great failures, because he doesn't need any approval from anybody. All he's got to do is put people in charge of this and get rid of it. So in my blog post, I put up some of these crazy things. The Department of Energy website, what do they have to say about climate? The headline is "Combating the Climate Crisis." There's no greater challenge facing our nation and our planet than the climate crisis. That's why President Biden has laid out his boldest climate agenda in our nation history, and on and on and on of this claptrap. And this can all be wiped away on the first day. And if they don't do it, they have nobody to blame but themselves. It's ridiculous that this stuff is out there. And it's not just the department, that was the Department of Energy, but the EPA has this, and all over the government. Even the SEC, financial regulator, and the Federal Reserve have somehow gotten into the climate business, and this all has to just be gotten rid of.
Yeah, we have got, as you mentioned, Francis, we've got the exact same thing. Every single, and we've had a new government now in New Zealand for a year, since the time we spoke last, that was just after the elections to this year. Nothing has changed. And the previous government under Jacinda Ardern, who now thankfully lives on your shores, seeing that she has gone to Prince William's board as a trustee on the One Earthshot Prize, where they give this annual $1 million grants to all these people who come up with earth-saving news. You can't imagine how bad it is in New Zealand. Honestly, you just cannot. There's no government website that does not speak about it. But out here, we have farmers vilified because, of course, it's methane. That's the huge part of a national inventory. It is far worse than anything you can imagine. I might be biased, but yeah, it is just as insane.
I'll bet you it is worse, except for one thing, which is that the U.S. government has virtually infinite funds to pass out, and they're just throwing them everywhere at anybody who mouths climate alarm gets whatever money they could possibly want.
Any excuse, yeah.
So the next thing, executive orders and actions. So, you know, the government acts by legislation, but there's also executive orders where the president could just write a document and sign it, which says, here is what I order you to do. And as long as it's within the law, they're ordered to do it. So that's how they can change the policy from the prior administration. Well, Biden just made one executive order after another on the climate crisis and directing an all of government response to the climate crisis. I listed some of them in my blog post. I think I looked up three of them and provided links, but I think there's more like 10. And by the way, these are not one-page documents. They're like 20 and 30-page documents with all kinds of directions to all kinds of people on what to do and how the government is going to totally transform the energy economy. So, I mean, all that stuff can also be wiped away. The Paris Climate Agreement. I think I mentioned before that a treaty in the U.S. has to be approved by the Senate. The president cannot just sign a treaty. It has to be approved by the Senate. Well, there's some doubt about exactly what is a treaty. Is this document a treaty or isn't it? Is it important enough to be a treaty? And the Paris Climate Agreement, you'd think that's important enough to be a treaty.
A treaty, yep.
You think it is, but in fact, the Obama administration, which entered into it in 2015, declared that it was not a treaty, and so Barack Obama signed it, and now we've joined it without ever submitting it to the Senate. And then, of course, Trump came in and said, we quit.
And Biden came in and reversed it on,
Biden
I think,
came
20
in and
January.
Back in.
Yep.
And now should Trump do that again? And The one thing I suggest, yes, he should, but the one thing I suggest is he should send it to the Senate bullshit, this is a treaty, send it to the Senate. The Senate will not approve it, and then it will be deader. More difficult to revive if the Democrats come back in. Then we have the whole area of regulations, which is a more complicated thing than executive orders. Regulations are something that are not provided for in the Constitution, and big regulations that purport to transform the economy without getting approved by Congress are of extremely dubious status under the Constitution, and the Supreme Court has recently struck some big ones down, including the regulation of the Obama administration that purported to outlaw fossil fuel power plants. That got struck down by the Supreme Court. Well, the Biden administration came back with another rule to purport to outlaw fossil fuel power plants to defy and challenge the Supreme Court. And that was only issued in April or May of 2024. So the litigation challenging it that will make it to the Supreme Court has already begun, but it will take years before it gets to the Supreme Court, and who knows what the Supreme Court is going to do. But Meanwhile, one of the things I suggest is that the Trump, and that's just an example, by the way, of multiples. There's other regulations like that purport to outlaw internal combustion automobiles in a gradual process.
If I may interrupt here, Francis, wasn't Kamala at one time in the beginning of the year, right till even the last few weeks, she was going to prosecute oil companies, and suddenly when that the big debate happened, suddenly everyone was all about climate realism. Until then, it was like a fracking ban here and prosecuting companies here. Hopefully that sort of comes through.
You're saying that you're saying Kamala
was against oil companies. Yeah, she was for prosecuting. Then came the big election, and then she suddenly changed at the big debate, and she changed stance.
Now, I could be wrong, but there are people who are advocating criminal prosecutions against oil companies. I don't believe I've seen Kamala advocate that.
Okay.
There are people who do advocate it. She may have at some point. She didn't.
I doubt she herself remembered much of what she said at different places. If there's one thing that struck was that she was not sticking to any one line of thought.
Well, what one thing she definitely did say is that, and this was in 2019 in the context of her then nascent aborted run for president in the previous cycle, she said she would ban fracking. And she answered a question on a questionnaire, and she also said it orally, so you can see her on video, saying she would ban fracking. So that's an example. And you know, meanwhile, the Biden administration has an all-of-government fossil fuel suppression program going on that includes the power plant rule that I told you about. It includes the electric vehicle rule that I told you about. It includes the ban restrictions of drilling on federal lands and offshore, which the federal government controls. One of the huge advantages the U.S. has over the rest of the world is the federal government cannot stop drilling and fracking on private land. They don't have the ability to do it. The states can do it within each state, but the federal government cannot do it. So that is how, in the face of an onslaught of attacks and regulation from the Biden Harris administration, nevertheless, the U.S. continues to increase its production of fossil fuels and to increase fracking because it's all on private land. But they're all of government attack on the fossil fuel industry has included restrictions on leasing on federal lands, restrictions on drilling on federal lands, restrictions on pipelines, restrictions on methane emissions, restrictions on mercury emissions, which are a necessary byproduct. And if you make the mercury emissions threshold teensy enough, you can make drilling impossible that way too. And on and on and on. They have an all of government onslaught against the fossil fuel industry. And most of these things are subject of litigation going on right now, because to start a case, you have to get through a district court, a court of appeals, and then you get to the Supreme Court. And a lot of these regulations the regulations took a couple of years to adopt. So they've only come out in the last year or two at most. And the litigation is in the early stages. One of the things that the Trump administration can do is they can change sides on the litigation and say, no, we're not supporting this regulation. We're supporting you striking it down. They can do that. So
the whole system's so damn convoluted. And so awkward. You wonder who's the mastermind behind a lot of these plans. And I have to say, the legal profession's probably got a lot to do with it, Francis.
Yes, the legal profession is a lot of fun. Now, my next idea is, how about a cost and feasibility study of net zero?
Oh, hooray.
Yes.
How did we ever get to the point of a multi-trillion dollar transformation of all the economies of the world to a new methods and new technologies, which are untested, and nobody knows if they'll work or not. And nobody has ever done a cost and feasibility study. And well, except people like me, and I haven't done the whole economy-wide cost or feasibility study, but I've done things like calculations of how much energy storage it would make to make wind and solar work. And it's not a complicated calculation. It involves mathematics, none of which is more advanced than the arithmetic you learned by sixth grade. And anybody can do it. It just takes some hard work because it's a lot of numbers and it takes some time. And maybe it's useful to use a spreadsheet like Excel, but it's just arithmetic and anybody can do it. And it shows that this is not feasible. And anybody who looks at it knows that it's not feasible. And yet the government plows ahead with religious fervor like this can be done. Now, maybe in New Zealand, if you have enough hydropower, maybe it can be done, but we do not have enough hydropower.
We nearly ran out this winter just gone, this May, June, July period, you know, our lakes were low. All of this happens, but you asked the question, how did we reach this position, Francis? And I just think it's the constant propaganda that's gone on, that we must try. Ours is not to reason why, ours is but to do or die.
We try our best. I mean, I get a good laugh out of it. It's ridiculous. It's completely absurd. But you know, their idea is we the smart bureaucrats issue orders. Carbon is bad, therefore we ban it, and somebody has to come up with a new energy system. Well, the little people will figure that out.
We'll figure that out. The propaganda has been relentless over decades. You know, I saw the whole thing during COVID happen. That's relentless, and it's the same thing. And now nothing is sacred. You know, you have very little children. You have in New Zealand, believe it or not, we've had kindergarten recently, a world record of 100 or something trained in a day on climate crisis, because it seems even 2 to 5 year olds must learn their climate alphabets before anything else. And so we have kindy teachers being trained in this. That's the absurdity, you know, the level at which we have fallen. And it would be a joke, it would be a laughing matter, but it's so damn serious.
And just if I could jump in, New Zealand had one survey or one report by a New Zealand chap who I think is at Cambridge or Oxford, Michael Kelly, Dr. Michael Kelly. And his
he writes reports for GWPF, where I'm on the
board. Yes. So he wrote that New Zealand, or he deduced that New Zealand would have a bill of $550 billion by 2050 to try and get to net zero. And I mean, effectively, if you took animal agriculture out of the equation, we're at net zero now. If you believe in any of this nonsense, we're at net zero now, and have been for some time. But he said at a minimum, $550 billion. And I think I recall something I watched on one of the American shows, that John Kerry or his people in his team talked a figure of 1.4 quadrillion for the world to go to net zero. So the redistribution machine was going printing money pretty fast. Hey, so you know, I imagine that there's so much corruption, so much cronyism. It's going to take a whole lot to turn this back. And you look at Elon Musk. A lot of people say, but oh, he was the benefactor of a whole lot of state money, you know, taxpayer money and setting up his businesses. And here he is the minute wanting to be on government efficiency. It seems a bit of a contradiction. How could you trust that guy? And I think I would trust Elon Musk more than John Kerry, to be blunt. But that's just my opinion from down under. Now, we are running short on time, but you've got one other point you want to talk about, and that's we're not trying to dismiss the net zero cost. It does need to be done. It's far from ever been assessed and put in the fronts of the mum and dad taxpayers in the country that you're in or we're in. But the last one is, there's a couple more, but the one
there's
about
a couple more, but I'll pick one.
Temperature adjustment, getting the facts right in terms of science and how the data has been tampered with. How are we going to get that front and center of all the policymakers? I mean, we get output from the likes of Roger Pielke Jr. and others who talk about how there's very little signal to say that things are getting more deleterious in the world, like floods, hurricanes, and I know you've just had some major ones, but they're not as we're being told. In fact, the only signal that is sort of positive is slightly warming world. how are we going to get this back boxed up? Because there's a big machine in behind climate variation, as I like to call it, rather than climate change. Climate variation is alive and well, but the climate change machine is all one way, and it's all about adding costs.
Well,
and it's all because it's based on a lot of falsehoods.
Yes, and hyping it and spreading fear. I mean, and this proposal that I have, to be honest with you, it's not going to end the hyping it and spreading fear. And on top of that, I've written a lot of blog posts on how the temperature data was tampered and adjusted to enhance the apparent warming, which has clearly gone on. Well, the last couple of years, just like Trump's election was more decisive than all the fraud that was arrayed against him, the warming of the last couple of years has been more decisive than the temperature adjustment fraud issue. So there actually has been some pretty decisive warming in the last few years. I mean, and by decisive, I mean a fraction of a degree, like 0.3 degree of a degree or 0.4 of a degree, which probably both in your studio and here in my hotel room, the temperature has changed by more than that during the hour that we've been talking. It's an amount that you can't perceive, but somehow they're able to spread fear about it. Now, even though there was a sudden spike in temperatures that is real, and the reason I say it's real, it's measured by the satellites, which are the only thing that I trust. Still, I think that the temperature adjustments of the data and the alterations and the tampering needs to be exposed. It has occurred. It probably is on the order of half a degree of adjustments and alterations.
Yep.
And that's not insignificant in this whole thing. It's not going to turn around the attempts to scare you with climate change. People are inherently subject to fear of nature and sin and redemption scenarios, and right, the weather gods, and we have to appease them by it's all caused by our bad behavior. This is not a phenomenon of the last 20 or 30 years of elite Western woke idiots. This is
gone on forever.
Nature going back since history has been recorded. However, I still think it's important to expose
absolutely
the temperature data alterations.
Well, it is, and it would be great to have honesty and integrity over all facets of everything we've discussed. I mean, wouldn't it be good that we didn't have to even discuss this stuff? But as I said, and I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but about 15 years ago, climate change policies, previously global warming, was the greatest job scheme ever devised by the likes of the woke left. And how they got away with it is unbelievable. They have done a massive job on us.
A massive and a masterful job.
Yes.
On the other hand, they do have going for them that humanity is very subject to fear and to sin and redemption narratives. And they tapped into that. And I just suggest to you that when this one goes away, which it will, particularly because all the proposed policies are ultimately not feasible and will never happen. Mm. So when it goes away, which it will, there will be another one, and it will probably be worse.
Yeah, sure. So look, I agree. There'll be something worse. We're going to wrap this up. Your last comment in your missive was around the Inflation Reduction Act, and you call it a fraudulently named act. Well, I would suggest it's a bit similar to what we have here, a net zero act. It's all about inflation addition, in my opinion. It's completely the opposite to how they present it, and hopefully that can be rescinded quickly as well.
Yes. Well, recognize that this is an act that was passed by Congress, and so it can be rescinded, but that requires the Congress to act in the way that Congress acts. So both houses of Congress have to pass it by majorities, and the president has to sign it. And as we discussed, there's this 60-vote requirement for many things in the Senate. However, if it is a financial matter that goes to the budget, it can be passed by a simple majority, but only at the time the budget is passed, which could be, it certainly won't be before July or August, and maybe late in the year. So, but that is something that should definitely be on their agenda. The Inflation Reduction Act has vast amounts of money, which are an entitlement that you can get if you build your wind turbine and your solar panels. You get tax credits and things, and they're uncapped. So there's vast
Slush
amount of,
funds.
so people say $1 trillion, it could be three or more because it's an uncapped slush fund, but it can be rescinded by a simple majority in Congress if they can get their act together.
All right. So,
Here's hoping, Francis.
yeah, and on that, we're going to have to conclude because we've overstayed our welcome with you, I'm sure. You've got lots more in your
I got to write
output
another
on,
blog post about something else.
on the Manhattan Contrarian. People can look up your work on that website. How is it? www.manhattancontrarian.com, and they will find all the output from Francis Benton, and go to the Global Warming Foundation and see their output as well. Francis, great to have you
Global
on.
Warming Policy Foundation.
Oh,
Global
sorry. Thank you.
thegwpf.org.
I knew I'd stuff that up. Trying to put too much in too quick. Great to have you back on our show. I know
Great to
it's
be on.
once over lightly, but we're trying to encourage people to think a bit wider than perhaps they have to date. And so great to have your output on the election and further the policy prescription that you would like to have. And as you said, there's lots more to come from you on
Lots
that.
more to come.
Thank you.
Thank you, Francis.
Okay, so long.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.